Good morning and welcome, everyone. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, July 28, 2009. We welcome those of you who have joined us today both in person and listening to the webcast of this meeting. Today, the board will consider a recommendation to adopt an auditing standard that would supersede the board's interim concurring partner review requirement. In addition, the board will also consider a recommendation to issue a concept release on requiring the engagement partner to sign the audit report. Before we proceed with the specific agenda items, I will note for the record that all members are present at today's meeting. The first order of business before the board today is a staff recommendation that the board adopt a new auditing standard on engagement quality review. To present the staff's recommendation on this agenda item, I will turn to our chief auditor, Martin Bauman. Marty.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board.
Good morning. Are you still there?
Oh.
Kind of a short...
Yes, am I coming through?
Yes. Please proceed.
Sorry. We are pleased this morning to recommend that the board adopt a new auditing standard entitled Engagement Quality Review. Existing requirements for an EQR and lead to a more meaningful engagement quality review process.
Marty, okay. He's on a cell phone. Okay, Marty, can you hear us? You're breaking up. Marty, is calling.
I was able to hear you fine. Was I not coming through?
You're not coming through. We're not getting your full dialogue or your full comments. And so, can Greg pick up from this point? Marty, why don't we just have Greg pick up from this point?
Fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. This morning, Dima, Andrianko, myself, and Marty would like to discuss the standard we are recommending today. This standard, like the reproposed standard, is intended to strengthen the existing requirements for engagement quality review and lead to a more meaningful review process. Also, it would supersede the board's existing concurring partner review requirement and apply equally to all registered firms. The refinement reflected in standard result from a constructive public comment process on two separate occasions. Before I continue with my remarks, I'd like to recognize the many people who made substantial contributions to this project. First, I'd like to thank Jake Lesser for his thoughtful insights and counsel throughout the process. Also, I'd like to thank Dima Andrianko for his long hours he put in throughout the process in bringing this to fruition. Also, I'd like to thank Aiko Powles and Jessica Watts on our staff for their analysis of the comments and the review and preparation of the final standard. Finally, I'd also like to thank the staff of the Securities and Exchange Commission who provided timely and very helpful assistance and advice throughout the process. The board's existing requirement for concurring partner reviews was initially adopted by the ASCCA is a membership requirement for its SEC practice section and subsequently was adopted by the board as part of the board's standards. Currently, registered firms that were not members of the SEC practice section, those were generally non-U.S. firms and some smaller firms, are not subject to this existing requirement. On February 26 of 2008, the board proposed to replace the existing requirement with a new auditing standard. Commenters recommended significant modifications to the original proposal. And in response, the board made changes designed to better tailor the standard to its purposes. Because of the extent of these changes, the board reproposed a revised standard on March 4th of this year. The board received 38 comment letters on the original proposal and 30 comment letters on the re-proposal. The board has considered these comments as well as the input of the SAG, and the final standard has benefited from the additional input in the comment process. The standard the staff is recommending today provides for a rigorous review that will serve as a meaningful check on the work performed by the engagement team. This standard should increase the likelihood that a registered accounting firm will catch any significant engagement deficiencies before it issues its audit report. The staff also has been sensitive to commenters' concerns and agrees that the engagement quality review should not become, in effect, a second audit. Instead, the engagement quality review should be a review of work already performed by the engagement team. This standard requires the engagement quality reviewer to evaluate the significant judgments made and related conclusions reached by the engagement team, informing the overall conclusion on the engagement and in preparing the engagement report, and requires certain procedures designed to focus the reviewer on those judgments and conclusions. This standard strengthens the existing requirements for an engagement quality review and should lead to a more meaningful process. Also, this standard, if adopted, would supersede the board's existing concurring partner review requirement and apply equally to all registered firms. First, let's talk about the applicability of the standard. The standard we are asking the board to adopt today would require an engagement quality review for each audit engagement and for each engagement to review interim financial information conducted pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB. The standard includes specific requirements for audits and interim reviews in two separate sections, each of which describes review procedures and criteria for providing concurring approval of issuance. The engagement quality review requirements for audits and interim reviews are customized to reflect the differences in scope between these two engagements. Turning to the objective. The objective of the engagement quality review is to perform an evaluation, again, of the significant judgments made by the engagement team and the related conclusions reached in forming the overall conclusion on the engagement and in preparing the engagement report, if such a report is issued, and in order to determine whether to provide, again, concurring approval of issuance. This objective is phrased as an objective for the engagement quality reviewer rather than an objective of the engagement quality review. To emphasize the responsibilities placed on a reviewer by this standard. The staff believes that this objective focuses auditors on the purpose of the standard as they comply with the more specific requirements of the standard and apply them to particular facts and circumstances. Applying the standard in light of its overall purpose should result in more effective and meaningful procedures and help auditors avoid a checklist approach. Before I turn the floor over to Dima, I'd like to highlight the last item is the effective date of the standard. This standard, if adopted by the board today and subject to SEC approval, would be effective for both the engagement quality review of audits and the engagement quality review of interim reviews for fiscal years beginning on or after December 15th of 2009. This effective date should allow for adequate time for registered firms to prepare for the adoption of this standard. I now would like to turn the floor over to Dima Andrianko, who will complete the overview of the standard. Dima?
Thank you, Greg. First, I would like to discuss qualifications required of the engagement quality reviewer. The standard describes the qualifications that any reviewer would be required to meet. An engagement quality reviewer from the firm that issues the engagement report must be a partner or another individual in an equivalent position. The engagement quality reviewer may also be an individual from outside the firm. Also, the engagement quality reviewer must be an associated person of a registered public accounting firm. These provisions are designed to provide assurance that the reviewer could effectively perform an EQR of the particular engagement under review. At the same time, the provisions recognize that smaller firms may have fewer partners available in-house to perform the EQR than larger firms. Accordingly, the standard requires an engagement co-leader reviewer from within the firm issuing the engagement report to be a partner or another individual in an equivalent position, but also allows a qualified individual from outside the firm to perform the EQR. In either event, the standard requires the reviewer to be an associated person of a registered public accounting firm. The standard also includes a general competence requirement and requirements related to the reviewer's independence, integrity, and objectivity. The requirement in the standard for a reviewer from within the firm to be a partner or an individual in an equivalent position was intended to address concerns expressed by some about the authority of the engagement quality reviewer relative to that of the engagement partner. Because the EQR is intended to be an objective second look at work performed by the engagement team, the reviewer should be able to withstand pressure from the engagement partner or other firm personnel, such as members of the firm's national office. The staff believes that concerns about authority will most often arise when the reviewer and the engagement partner work at the same firm. These concerns are addressed by the requirement that an in-house reviewer be a partner or a person in an equivalent position. At a firm that is not organized as a partnership, an individual in an equivalent position is someone with the degree of authority and responsibility of a partner in a firm that is organized as a partnership. The EQR standard allows registered firms flexibility in choosing a reviewer, provided that the reviewer meets the competence and other qualification requirements. Some persons from outside a firm might not have the required qualifications, but those who do can effectively perform the EQR. When considering an outside individual for the role of the engagement quality reviewer, the firm will likely need to make additional inquiries to obtain necessary information about the individual's qualifications. For example, while information about the independence of the firm's partners is typically collected and evaluated as part of the periodic independence review, information about the independence of an outside reviewer will likely need to be requested and evaluated as part of the reviewer selection process. Firms are also likely to know more about the competence of their own partners than of an outside reviewer. An engagement quality reviewer must have competence, independence, integrity, and objectivity. The engagement quality reviewer also must possess the level of knowledge and competence related to accounting, auditing, and financial reporting required to serve as the engagement partner on the engagement under review. The standard also includes a provision prohibiting an engagement partner from serving as the engagement quality reviewer for at least 2 years after his or her last year as the engagement partner, because it would be harder for an engagement partner who has had overall responsibility for the audit for at least a year to perform the review level of objectivity. This cooling off period will be beneficial to audit quality. However, compliance with such a requirement could be difficult for smaller firms with fewer personnel. In its independence rules, the SEC exempted certain smaller firms from the audit partner rotation requirements. Under the standard, firms that qualify for the exemption from the SEC partner rotation requirements will also be exempt from the cooling off period. Now I'll provide a brief overview of the EQR process. In an audit engagement and an engagement to review interim financial information, the reviewer should evaluate the significant judgments made by the engagement team and the related conclusions reached in forming the overall conclusion on the engagement and in preparing the engagement report. To evaluate the judgments and conclusions, the engagement quality reviewer should hold discussions with engagement partner and other members of the engagement team and review documentation. The standard requires certain procedures that are designed to provide the reviewer with the necessary information to evaluate the engagement team's significant judgments and conclusions. In an audit, the engagement quality reviewer should evaluate whether the engagement documentation that he or she reviewed indicates that the engagement team responded appropriately to significant risks and supports the conclusions reached by the engagement team with respect to the matters reviewed. Similarly, in a review of interim financial information, the engagement quality reviewer should evaluate whether the engagement documentation that he or she reviewed supports the conclusions reached by the engagement team with respect to the matters reviewed. Now I would like to discuss the subject of concurrent approval of issuance. The genesis of the phrase concurrent approval of issuance is from Section 103 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. This section of the Act directs the board, among other things, to set standards for public company audits, including a requirement for each registered public accounting firm to, and I quote, provide a concurrent or second partner review and approval of each audit report and other related information, and concurrent approval in its issuance, end quote. In an audit, the engagement quality reviewer may provide concurrent approval of issuance only if, after performing with due professional care, the review required by the standard, he or she is not aware of a significant engagement deficiency. A significant engagement deficiency in an audit exists when the engagement team fails to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence in accordance with the standards of the PCAOB, the engagement team reached an inappropriate overall conclusion on the subject matter of the engagement, the engagement report is not appropriate in the circumstances, or the firm is not independent of its client. The standards requirement for providing concurrent approval of issuance in an EQR of an interim review are the same as those of an audit, except that the first of these four conditions has been modified in light of the differences between an interim review and an audit. Specifically, in an EQR of an interim review, the first condition is the engagement team failed to perform interim review procedures necessary in the circumstances of the engagement, rather than the engagement team failed to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence in accordance with the standards of the PCAOB. The purpose of the required procedures in an EQR is to provide the reviewer with a sufficient basis to make a meaningful decision about whether to concur in the issuance of the report. That decision must be based upon knowledge about the engagement obtained through performance of the standards requirements. But concurrent approval of issuance is not a second opinion, and a reviewer does not need to perform a second audit in order to provide it. In an audit, the firm may grant permission to the client to use the engagement report only after the engagement quality reviewer provides concurrent approval of issuance. Similarly, in a review of interim financial information, the firm may grant permission to the client to use the engagement report or communicate an engagement conclusion to its client if no report is issued, only after the engagement quality reviewer provides concurrent approval of issuance. Now, the last topic I would like to discuss is documentation of the EQR. The standard includes a general requirement that places the specific documentation requirements in the context of the overall purpose of EQR documentation, that is, to provide a record of how the reviewer carried out the review in accordance with the standards. Specifically, the EQR documentation should contain sufficient information to enable an experienced auditor, having no previous connection with the engagement, to understand the procedures performed by the engagement quality reviewer and others who assisted the reviewer to comply with the provisions of the standards. For example, if a reviewer identifies a significant engagement deficiency, the EQR documentation should be sufficient to understand, for example, the deficiency identified, how the reviewer communicated it to the engagement team, why such matter was important, and how the reviewer evaluated the engagement team's response. The engagement team should document its response to the identified deficiency in accordance with AS3. Because the standard does not require duplication of documentation prepared by the engagement team, the engagement quality reviewer does not have to separately document the engagement team's response. This concludes our remarks on the auditing standard on engagement quality review that we are recommending the board adopt today. Now we're available to take your questions.
Well, thank you both. Thank Marty, also Greg and Dima. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
And Mr. Niemeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board adopt the standard on engagement quality review as recommended and instruct the staff to submit it to the SEC for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
Is there a second?
Mr. Chairman, I second the motion.
Thank you, Charlie and Dan. The motion has been made and seconded, so the question before the board today is whether it will approve the motion and adopt the auditing standard on engagement quality review and a conforming amendment to the board's interim quality control standards. Before I turn to my fellow board members for comment, I would like to thank Marty, Greg, and Dima and their colleagues in the Office of the Chief Auditor for their hard work on this new standard. And I would also like to thank Jake Lesser and his colleagues in the Office of the General Counsel, who continue to provide our standard setters with wise counsel. My initial interest in this issue was stimulated in 2006 by my first meetings with our inspections people in the PCAOB regional offices. As part of those meetings with inspectors, I would inquire as to which audit issues they found more problematic. Among the most frequently mentioned issues of concern was the wide range of quality and rigor of the concurring partner or second partner reviews. The board initially proposed this auditing standard in February of 2008. In response to feedback and numerous comments on the proposed standard, the board reproposed the standard with revisions in March of 2009. The board's objective in developing a new EQR standard was to strengthen the review procedures and develop a more meaningful EQR process. As I mentioned in March, because of the importance that the PCAOB places on engagement quality review, the strong set of second eyes on the audit is critical to audit quality. At the same time, the EQR is not intended to become a second audit. As Greg emphasized, this approach appropriately focuses the review procedures on the areas of a particular audit that are more likely to have significant engagement deficiencies. The reviewer is required to evaluate the significant judgments made and related conclusions reached by the engagement team, and to evaluate the engagement team's assessment of the responses to significant risk, including fraud risks. The standard also takes into account concerns that were expressed by smaller accounting firms with limited resources. In particular, the standard allows firms the flexibility to use a qualified reviewer from outside the firm. The standard also exempts certain small firms from the 2-year cooling off period. However, these aspects are not detrimental to the quality of the EQR. Any reviewer a firm uses must meet the qualification requirements of the final standard. The final standard also adopts the concurring approval of issuance requirements as included in the reproposed standard. The board and staff have carefully considered the comments and robust discussion on the requirement for the reviewer to conduct his or her work with due professional care. Conducting the review with reasonable care and diligence is an appropriate prerequisite to providing concurring approval of issuance. Section 103 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act mandated that the PCAOB adopt a requirement that each registered public accounting firm provide a concurring or second partner review of each audit report. The standard before us today is the culmination of 2 rounds of public comment, input from our standing advisory group, observations from our inspections and enforcement staff, and a review of the current requirements of the IAASB standards. The final standard has benefited from and been improved as a result of the 68 comments received in both public comment periods. The net result is a standard that is robust and viable. I support the issuance of auditing standard number 7 today as an important and tangible enhancement to audit quality. I will now turn to my fellow board members for any discussion, and we'll start with Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a statement, and then I'd like to ask the staff a couple of questions about the proposal. The adoption of the final standard on engagement quality review, what we call EQR, is a milestone in fulfilling the board's mandate. In the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Congress expressly directed the board to require a qualified person to provide concurring approval of the issuance of every audit report filed with the SEC. Based on 6 years of inspections experience, it's clear that engagement quality reviews have the potential to improve auditing and promote confidence in audited financial statements. The board's inspection staff routinely identifies audit deficiencies that a properly performed concurring partner review should have detected and caused to be remedied before the audit report was issued. However, since beginning operations in 2003, the board has relied on the concurring partner requirements developed in a different environment before the board's creation. Those current rules are not applicable to all firms that prepare audit reports for commission filers. Auditing standard number 7, the board's new EQR standard, will fill those gaps. The EQR standard has had a long gestation period. Earlier versions of auditing standard number 7 were published for comment in 2008 and again in March of this year. I think that time has been well spent and that the result is a better, more workable standard. For a project of the importance of EQR, we should take all reasonable steps to obtain input on the practical consequences of the standard. And as has been noted already, this proceeding has generated a particularly robust comment file. Comments were critical of particular features of the two proposals and argued that certain elements were either not workable or would result in an engagement review process that was more costly and cumbersome than necessary. I think that auditing standard number 7 addresses these concerns without compromising the goal of increasing the likelihood that reviewers will identify any significant engagement deficiencies before audit reports are issued. I'd like to highlight 3 things in particular. First, the commenters have been concerned that the EQR standard would inadvertently drive the engagement reviewer to, in effect, perform a re-audit. In its final form, auditing standard number 7 focuses the reviewer on the engagement team's significant judgments and on the team's responses to the significant risks it identified. While this will require judgment and sophistication on the part of reviewers, the standard makes clear they're responsible for evaluating how the engagement team identified and responded to risk, not for starting from scratch to assess risk independently. This should alleviate the concern that engagement quality review turn into a re-audit. Second, the standard that the reviewer must meet in determining whether to provide concurring approval has been a major source of debate. Understandably, reviewers are sensitive to the criterion against which the board, the SEC, and potentially the courts will measure their work. Under auditing standard number 7, the reviewer may provide concurring approval only if, after performing the required review with due professional care, he or she is not aware of a significant engagement deficiency. This tethers the reviewer's responsibility to his or her performance of the procedures required in the standard, rather than to a free-floating obligation not to concur if he or she knows or should know any fact that makes concurrence inappropriate. Further, the concept of acting with due professional care has long been embedded in auditing and should be familiar to the profession. Third, the extent and nature of the documentation that the reviewer must create to memorialize his or her work has been a major concern. Auditing standard number 7 invokes the same principle that governs the engagement team's work paper documentation. That is, the EQR documentation must be sufficient to enable an experienced auditor having no previous connection with the engagement to understand the procedures performed by the reviewer. The adopting release makes clear that this requirement is not intended to cause the reviewer's documentation to duplicate the audit work papers. For example, if the reviewer raises an issue with the engagement team, the reviewer's documentation only needs to reflect that discussion if it's necessary to an understanding of his work and it isn't fully reflected in the engagement work paper. I believe that auditing standard number 7 strikes the right balance in addressing these and the other difficult issues that the two comment periods have exposed. The burden will now fall to our inspection staff to monitor how the standard works in practice and how it affects audit quality. I also want to join in thanking everyone that's been involved in this project, particularly Marty Bauman, may or may not be with us on the phone, Greg Skates, Dima Andrienko, all in the Office of the Chief Auditor, and Jake Lesser in the Office of the General Counsel, for their diligent and thoughtful efforts in bringing this final standard to the board. With that, let me ask you just a couple of questions about some of the things that you've already mentioned here. Early on, one of the issues in this standard was whether it should contain an objective, and of course now there is an objective set forth in paragraph 2 of the standard, which is essentially to perform an evaluation of the significant judgments and related conclusions reached in the audit. And that, particularly that phrase, significant judgment, appears in other places in the standard. It's certainly one of the keys to the standard. I wonder if you can explain what a significant judgment is. Is that defined anywhere in our standards or in this standard? How will people recognize a significant judgment when they bump into one?
The term significant judgment is not defined in our standard. It's not defined in standards of other standards. It's a relative term, and you have to look at it in the context of the way it's used. Let me give you a couple of examples. One, when the engagement team documents the significant issues and matters that come to their attention during the audit or review, they place those in what we refer to as an engagement completion document required by our auditing standard number 3 on audit documentation. Those significant matters include significant judgments that have been made by the engagement team in arriving at those conclusions they arrive at that they document in that completion document. And those can take, there's a variety of issues that come up. One would be significant judgments they make about materiality, planning materiality, you know, what's in the scope of the engagement, what segments or subsidiaries are they going to have a full scope audit, which ones are going to have limited scope audits. Those are significant judgments that are made by the engagement team that are important in the overall assessment and arriving at an overall conclusion that's important to the engagement quality reviewer, and he or she needs to be aware of those and look at those and study those significant judgments and challenge them from that point of view. So it's really it's a relative term, again, based on from an auditor's point of view, they recognize a significant judgment when they see it because it impacts what they're going to do down the road, and it could impact the scope of the audit as well as decisions they make in other areas.
I think one of the things you said then is that the engagement completion document, at least a properly prepared one, is kind of a link between the engagement team's evaluation of the significant judgments and the starting point, at least, of the reviewer's work. I just to press it a little further, the phrase in the objective is significant judgments and the related conclusions. What's a conclusion related to a significant judgment?
Again, that's related conclusions. Is also not a defined term, but again, if you look at it, editing in context of what you're looking at. For example, in an audit of the allowance for loan losses or the loan loss reserve, of course, the loan loss reserve would be important material account of a financial institution. And in auditing that account, the engagement team is going to, they will perform certain procedures and they will make significant judgments as far as the scope of the work and the evidence they obtain in determining whether the allowance or reserve is sufficient or adequate. And then that information is gathered, and then at the end they arrive at a conclusion. That is a significant conclusion with respect to their material account, like loan loss reserve. You know, is the reserve adequate?
Okay, well, just one more in this series. Paragraph 10, which kind of the heart of the standard in describing what the reviewer is supposed to do, requires the reviewer to evaluate the engagement team's response to significant risks. Now, significant risk is a defined term, a risk that's important enough to require special audit consideration, I think is the definition.
Yeah, it's a defined term. It's actually defined in one of the board's recently proposed standards on identifying and assessing risk of material misstatement. And so the definition that is used there, and it's also included in the EQR standard, is it's a risk of material misstatement that is important enough to require special audit consideration.
A cynical person might say that's a circular definition. So it's important. It's significant. Mean the same thing. But I'll let that go. What I wanted to ask is whether there's a connection between a significant risk and a significant judgment. Are significant judgments made about significant risks, or are the two terms not directly related?
There's certainly a connection, and in an audit of successful. For example, a financial institution, a significant risk might be an impairment of assets. And in dealing with such a risk, the engagement team may deal with multitude of significant judgments. For example, the judgments may be related to the application by their client of particular accounting pronouncements or judgments related to the sufficiency of audit evidence that the engagement team obtained.
All right, well, I think that covers the adjectives. Let's move to the verbs now. Paragraph 10, again, which is the sort of the heart of the standard that talks about what the reviewer is supposed to do, requires the reviewer to evaluate certain judgments that the engagement team made, to review certain documents and the engagement team's evaluation of independence, and then to read certain other documents, essentially the other SEC filings or the SEC filings of the company. Can you explain what the difference is between evaluating, reviewing, and reading something? I don't think any of those are defined terms.
Right, that's right, Dan. They're not defined terms in our standards. Let's start with the evaluate. In evaluating, in the context of the engagement quality reviewer, will what I like to refer to as challenge. They're going, he or she will challenge the audit scope, planning the audit, the judgments about materiality and other matters. He or she is going to evaluate what the decisions that the engagement team arrived at. So I refer to, you know, evaluate to me is more of a challenge them on the particular issue at hand. And but it's very important, that term is very important in that, because at the end, the engagement team is going to arrive at an overall conclusion, and there's much that the engagement quality reviewer needs to evaluate or challenge the team on certain issues in order for them to arrive at that conclusion. The review, review and read are somewhat similar terms. Some people would view them to be almost synonymous. Others would view there's a distinct difference between the two. I consider read to be you're going to read the information and glean certain knowledge or glean information from that will further your the engagement quality review process. Review, I view it more as the person is going to scrutinize or analyze the particular information. But again, it's very succinct between review and read it. And some people would view them to have very similar definitions.
At least the read requirement with respect to the other documents matches what the engagement team is required.
Yes, in certain contexts. For example, with respect to other information that's contained with the financial statements that are filed with the SEC, the engagement team is required to read that other information to see if there's any material misstatements of fact or if anything's inconsistent with the financial statement. So that's the way that term's used there in as far as read.
I guess the main thing I've taken away from what you've said, and tell me my boss, is that when we use evaluate, there's an element of challenge.
Yes.
Analyze critically.
Yes.
Just one more along those lines. Then, the paragraph 10 originally, or in the last version, required the reviewer to determine if appropriate matters had been communicated to the audit committee. Now it requires person to evaluate whether appropriate matters have been communicated. I'm kind of scratching my head over what the difference is between determining if something has occurred and evaluating whether it's occurred. How do you fit that into the construct you just described?
Yeah, I'll take this one. There was one other change made to that particular provision. So the new requirement now reads, based on the procedures required by the standard. So in combination, these two changes make this particular requirement consistent with the overall objective. In other words, to evaluate the communication that that were made by the engagement team is consistent with their overall objective to evaluate the significant judgments made and conclusions reached by the engagement team, as opposed to requiring the reviewer to determine whether all such communications have taken place. So that's the difference.
So it's, I guess, as I said in my statement, it's tethered to performing the procedures in the statement, not a free-flowing.
This is a good example of that, yes.
Just a couple of other quick things. The something that bothered a number of the commenters was the requirement for the EQR documentation to list all of the documents reviewed. It really goes beyond the requirement that the engagement team at least expressly would have for its documentation. What's the thinking there?
Well, I don't believe it goes beyond what's required of the team, because the you got to put it in context of what we're as far as the engagement team versus the engagement quality reviewer. The engagement team gathers original evidence, and the team is required, according to our standard, Auditing Standard 3, to document the procedures performed. That includes nature, time, and extent of procedures, the evidence obtained, and then the conclusions reached. And they're required to comply with those, with that, under AS3. So they gather the evidence that the engagement quality reviewer is going to now look at. So the engagement quality reviewer does not perform any original work to arrive at and examine original evidence to support the opinion. He or she reviews the work previously performed by the engagement team, and then so the difference there is the engagement team clearly notes throughout the work papers all the documents that they reviewed, when they reviewed them, and who reviewed it, and who performed the work, and then who reviewed that work. The engagement quality reviewer, though, is just required to review certain documents, and then he or she should then indicate what documents he or she reviewed, and that will then comply with our standards, because it will evidence that someone, an experienced auditor outside, not connected with the engagement, can look and see what he or she did in that review.
Okay, I think in some ways it's perhaps a tool for our inspection staff to understand what happened or what the reviewer became aware of.
Yeah.
Just a couple other quick things. You discussed the qualifications of the reviewer and the point that a firm can select someone from outside the firm. If they select someone from the firm, that person must be a partner or the equivalent of a partner. If they may select someone from outside the firm, provided that person meets the competency and independence requirements. But that person would have to be, the outsider would have to be an associated person of some firm. So if they select, for example, an academic, perhaps not connected to any accounting firm, then that individual is going to have to become an associated person of the firm for which they're doing the EQR. Am I right so far?
That's correct.
Does that then make them from the firm, such that they have to be made a partner of the firm?
No, they would not. They're not be required to be a partner or employee of the firm. But they would be required to be associated with the firm, like other members. But they would not take on any role, though, as an employee or partner or anything like that. They would still be outside the firm.
I guess when we say you have to be a partner if you're from the firm, that means it has a temporal element to it. If you weren't from the firm when we first met you, then you don't have to be a partner. At least it's not the equivalent of being an associated person.
Yeah, I see your point, but the person outside, though, I mean, the person outside is we require by this standard that they clearly, even though they're outside the firm, they're going to have to be associated with this particular firm. But if they're already associated with another firm, then they would not have to be, because they have to be associated with a registered firm.
Okay, well, I think I understand it, at least that. I know if other people don't, it might be a subject of a FAQ someday or something like that. I think something that hasn't been mentioned here, and I just want to flag, is that this release has an appendix that compares AS7, our new EQR standard, to the auditing standards board's concurring partner standard and to the ISO, the IAASB's concurring partner standard. And I think that's something that's very useful. I hope it'll become a regular feature of our releases. Just the one thing I'd ask you about it, in order to do such a comparison, we have to have a little paraphrase of each of our standards. I think we've usually taken the position that everything in our releases is authoritative, although maybe not. Is Appendix 3 authoritative? Can you rely on the description of EQR that's in that appendix as opposed to the description in the standard itself?
As you indicated, Dan, the release is authoritative. However, in the appendix, we indicate that the appendix is Appendix 3 to the standard is for information purposes only and is not a substitute for the standard itself. So anything in there is not meant to indicate. Any auditor that's going to perform an engagement quality reviewer should go to the standard and look to the standard for the guidance and direction and not to that appendix. Again, the appendix is only for one purpose only, and that is to compare our standard to the standards of other standard setters.
And just to be sure, this same statement is also included in the release when the appendix is first introduced. There's also a statement that compliance with AS7 is required for a registered firm.
Okay, and then at last but not least, just for the sake of clarity, for calendar year companies, what's the first annual audit that will be subject to EQR, and what's the first interim quarterly filing?
Well, the first annual filing will be December 31st, 2010, and the first interim period, and that's for calendar year filers, would be March 31st, 2010.
And how will those dates change if the SEC doesn't approve this standard by, let's say, the end of this year? Say they approve it next April.
If there were to be a delay in the approval, then the staff would recommend that the board delay the implementation or the effective date of the standard accordingly. But we'd have to look at the date at that time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Charlie.
I'd also like to start by thanking the staff for bringing forward this proposal. There's a lot of people in Bob, but in particular, Marty, Greg, Dima, and Jake, for all their hard work. You have thoughtfully and thoroughly analyzed the comments we received on two consecutive proposals as the board refined the refinements and requirements for this important standard. The product today not only reflects all that work, but also reflects your entire commitment to developing standards that as others have mentioned, this is one of a handful of standards that Sarbanes-Oxley expressly requires the board to adopt, but that is by no means the only reason to adopt a standard. Our inspections continue to find serious audit deficiencies at both large and small firms. Better engagement quality reviews could catch those deficiencies and prevent investor harm. Since the board first proposed this standard, we have refined it in several respects. I would like to call attention to two areas in particular which were subject to substantial comments. First, several commenters expressed concern that engagement quality review should not be tantamount to a re-audit. To my mind, this comparison is misplaced. The standard is intended to be rigorous because our inspection record amply demonstrates renewed rigor is justified, but it is not intended to be a re-audit. Rather, the review is simply that, a review of work already performed by the engagement team. To accomplish this, the reviewer uses three tools. The standard expects the reviewer to talk with the engagement partner and team members, review certain relevant documents, and apply some critical thinking to determine whether to sign off with concurring approval. The reviewer doesn't do any testing, request any confirmations, conduct any walkthroughs, or perform any other procedures that are necessary to obtain reasonable assurance that the financial statements are fairly stated. There's simply no way to see this as a re-audit, which is indeed an enormous undertaking. Regrettably, in some circumstances, companies do undergo re-audits. For example, when a problem has been discovered too late and a restatement is required, a well-performed engagement quality review should significantly reduce the risk of such a problem. Anyone who has been through a restatement and a re-audit will tell you that a timely, high-quality engagement review is well worth the burden and cost to avoid much larger burdens and costs later. The second topic I'd like to raise is documentation. The board's proposals have gone through considerable refinement in this regard. Several commentators have cautioned that EQR documentation should not duplicate the engagement documentation. It's hard for me to see how this could happen as a practical matter, since the reviewer performs different procedures than those performed by the engagement team. The reviewer's documentation will be different, too. But the comments have also been helpful to refining our documentation requirement to be as clear as possible. Documentation allows third parties, such as inspectors, to understand the reviewer's work and evaluate whether it complies with the standard. The comments have focused us on this goal. Thus, quite simply, the standard requires reviewers to document the procedures they performed in a manner that enables third-party review, but without requiring more than would be necessary for that review. And I'd like to thank all those who put time and effort into submitting comments. They were extremely helpful in guiding the board in this direction and the staff. Thank you.
Bill. Mr. Chairman, I also would like to join my colleagues in thanking the staff for a job well done. I also want to acknowledge what I think is the significance of Appendix 3, which Dan has already mentioned. In a sense, it explicitly acknowledges that we're not the only game in town, or at least not if you think in international terms. There are three standard setters. We're one of them. Putting in this appendix reflects that. It will be helpful, for example, to an auditor who is, say, abroad, that is schooled in the international standards but not that familiar with ours, to help them understand what additional steps they would make. Need to make, and also those many auditors in the United States who will be using the auditing standards board standard for their non-issuer clients, and our standards, of course, where issuers are involved. In fact, even the content of our standard reflects, as I see it, some influence from the examination of the international standards, specifically the statement of an objective up front, right towards the beginning of the standard itself. I truly hope that the way this is laid out will serve to be a template, something that the board will continue in the future, that is, to indicate the way in which our standards compare with the others. And I finally want to suggest that the very process of looking at the other standards in a sense forces us to ask ourselves the question, are these additional steps necessary? Do they provide value? This standard certainly meets that test. I'm strongly supportive of it, and I want to acknowledge once again the hard work over a long period of time by many people, including my colleagues on the board, that have been involved in this process.
Steve. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also support the adoption of auditing standard number 7, the board's engagement quality review, or EQR standard. As I said when this standard was reproposed last March, Congress had the investing public in mind when it directed the PCAOB to require a second partner review for every audit of a U.S. public company under Section 103 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I believe the requirements of this standard make important improvements over our existing interim standard, and that with the adoption of this standard, the quality of the EQR process will improve substantially. I'm also confident that given time, the number of concerns related to poorly performed second partner reviews identified during our inspections process will diminish. In short, the EQR standard will give investors added confidence in the quality of the audits of financial statements filed with the SEC. I also believe this standard improves upon comparable standards issued by other standard-setting bodies. As Dan and Bill mentioned, Appendix 3 of the standard was added to help demonstrate key differences between the EQR standard and standards issued by the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board and the Auditing Standards Board. For example, the EQR standard requires concurring approval of issuances by the engagement quality reviewer before an audit firm can grant permission to the client to use the audit report. Neither of the comparable standards issued by the IASB or ASB requires the same level of assurance. The EQR standard requires that appropriate documentation of the EQR process, including the documentation that's specifically described in the standard, be included as a part of the engagement documentation, and that the requirements in AAS number 3 audit documentation related to subsequent changes to audit documentation and audit and document retention be followed. These requirements are in direct response to documentation deficiencies related to second partner reviews identified by the PCOB inspections process. There are no provisions specifically related to subsequent changes to or attention or retention of the EQR documentation in either the IAASB standards or the ASB standard. The EQR standard includes a requirement that the reviewer evaluate whether the engagement documentation, one, indicates that the engagement team responded appropriately to significant risks, and two, supports the conclusion reached by the engagement team. Although the IAASB standards contain a similar documentation review requirement, the ASB standard does not contain an equivalent requirement. The EQR standard requires the engagement quality reviewer to be an associated person of the accounting firm and comply with all applicable independence requirements. In addition, the standard prohibits the engagement quality reviewer from having had overall responsibility for the audit client for at least 2 years prior to serving as the review partner. Neither the IAASB nor the ASB standards require the engagement partner reviewer to comply with the 2-year cooling off period, nor do they require the reviewer to be an associated person of the firm. The IAASB standards do not include reviewer independence requirements. I would like to thank Marty Bauman in his new role as chief auditor for ensuring that this comparison in Appendix 3 is available to provide examples of how this EQR standard provides investors with a higher level of confidence in audits of U.S. publicly traded companies. I think this is a valuable new initiative of the chief auditor. I look forward to seeing this type of comparison included in future standards issued by the PCAOB. In closing, I would like to make the observation that by considering concerns identified during our inspection process and soliciting input from our standing advisory group, as well as the public at large through our proposal process, the PCOB was in the unique position to make important improvements to the engagement review process. By enhancing the review performed by a second partner, investors will now have greater assurances that audits performed by registered accounting firms are at their highest level of audit quality. I would like to thank our staff for their work on this standard, in particular Greg and Dima in our Office of Chief Auditor, and Jake Lester in our Office of General Counsel, and of course you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks to everybody. If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. Thank you, Bella. Our second agenda item today is a staff recommendation concerning a concept release on the engagement partner signing the audit report. Assuming we are still in contact, we will turn now to our chief auditor, Marty Bauman, for this recommendation. Marty, are you there? He's not there. It's relatively early in the football season, but we'll try an audible, that being the case. So we'll move directly to Bella and Greg.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We now would like to recommend that the board issue for public comment a concept release on whether the board should require the engagement partner to sign the audit report. As Bella Rischen, Associate Chief Auditor, will discuss in a few minutes, the standards of the board do not currently require the auditor with final responsibility for the audit to sign the audit report. In October 2008, the Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession, convened by the U.S. Department of Treasury, recommended that the PCOB undertake a standard-setting initiative to consider mandating the engagement partner signature on the auditor's report, because the committee believed that the engagement partner signature on the auditor's report would increase transparency and accountability. concept release would seek comment on whether the board should impose such a requirement, which would be in addition to and not in place of the existing requirement for the firm to sign the audit report. Before I turn the floor over to Bill, I'd also like to thank Jake Lesser and Mary Peters in the Office of General Counsel for their contributions and thoughtful insight and advice on this project. Additionally, I'd like to thank again the staff of the Securities and Exchange Commission who provided a very helpful assistance and advice throughout in the creation and drafting of this concept release. I now would like to turn the floor over to Bella Rishkin, again our Associate Chief Auditor, who will provide an overview of this proposal.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. A public company audit typically involves a substantial amount of work by highly skilled practitioners exercising significant professional judgment. At the end of this process, a registered public accounting firm issues its report on a client's financial statements and, when applicable, its internal controller of financial reporting. An audit report is usually the only document related to the audit that the investors see. Among other things, it describes in general terms the work required to be performed in every audit, represents that the work was performed in accordance with the standards of the PCAOB, and most importantly to investors, states the auditor's opinion. As Greg mentioned, the current standards of the PCAOB do not only require the audit report to be signed by the audit firm. Because of the audit report's importance, commentators have, at various times, considered ways to make it more informative and whether changes to the standard audit report could enhance audit quality. In addition to the Department of Treasury's Advisory Committee recommendation, the PCAOB Standing Advisory Group, comprised of members with backgrounds in auditing, accounting, corporate governance, and investing in public companies, discussed three times whether the standards of the PCAOB should require engagement partners to sign the audit report. Members of the SAG with backgrounds as investors have generally strongly supported such a requirement. These SAG members generally believe that a signature requirement could enhance the engagement partner's accountability and increase transparency. Some other SAG members have expressed concerns and noted the benefits of the existing requirement for the firm to sign the audit report. The staff believes that a requirement for the engagement partner to sign the audit report could improve audit quality in two ways. First, it might increase the engagement partner's sense of accountability to financial statement users, which would lead him or her to exercise greater care in performing the audit. Second, it would increase transparency about who is responsible for performing the audit, which could provide useful information to investors and in turn provide additional incentive to firms to improve the quality of all of their engagement partners. Many have suggested that the engagement partner who knows that he or she will have to sign his or her own name to an engagement report will perform a higher quality audit because the act of signing one own name to the audit report may increase the individual sense of personal accountability for the work performed and the opinion expressed, which could in turn have a positive effect on his or her behavior. Additionally, providing financial statement users, audit committees, and others with the name of the engagement partner might help them evaluate the extent of that engagement partner's experience on a particular type of audit and to a degree his or her track record. Such information could be useful to investors in making investment decisions and to audit committees in making retention or hiring decisions. Over time, additional transparency could also provide an incentive for firms to enhance the skill and experience of their engagement partners overall. Audit committees might increasingly seek out engagement partners who are viewed as performing consistently high-quality audits. The resulting competition could lead to an improvement in audit quality. Some have suggested that the firm's signature on the audit report is often used as a statement that the firm, as a whole, stands by the opinions expressed. The opinion and other statements in the report are those of the firm, collectively, rather than the individual engagement partner who authorized the report's issuance. Some believe that such collective responsibility promotes audit quality because individual partners risk not only their own reputations by performing substantial audit work, but those of their partners and employees as well. The firm's signature on the audit report may also reflect the fact that the audit often involves consultations with the firm's national office, and others who may not participate more directly in the day-to-day audit work. The firm's signature on the audit report serves important goals, and the intent of any signature requirements would not be to suggest that the firm as a whole is not accountable for the contents of its audit report, or the engagement partner is solely responsible for the audit. In addition to seeking comment regarding the potential benefits to audit quality of such a requirement, the concept release would also seek comment regarding its potential effects on private liability, other unintended consequences that might result, and potential complexities in implementing such a requirement. The concept release discusses that the signature requirement could be imposed by amending paragraph H of AU Section 508 in the Board's auditing standards and paragraph 85 of auditing standard number 5, each of which describe the elements of the standard audit report. These paragraphs currently require that the audit report include the manual or printed signature of the auditor's firm. A requirement for the manual or printed signature of the auditor with final responsibility for the audit could be added to those paragraphs. Additionally, the concept release would seek comment on whether the current year engagement partner should be required to sign an audit report only as it relates to the year for which he or she served in that role. In general, the audit report contains an opinion on prior year's financial statements in addition to the opinions of those of the current year. For a variety of reasons, however, including partner rotation requirements, the engagement partner on the current year's audit may not be the person who served in that role on the audit of the prior years presented in the report. This may be the case even if the same audit firm audited all the years presented. Similar issues could arise when prior period financials are revised. Finally, the staff is considering how an engagement partner signature requirement would apply when part of the audit is performed by another auditor. Under the board's auditing standard, AU Section 543, the principal auditor must decide whether to make reference to the other auditor in the audit report or assume responsibility for the other auditor's work. If a signature requirement is adopted, it may be appropriate, for example, for the principal auditor that makes reference to the other auditor to also reference the other engagement partner. In summary, we recommend that the board issue the concept release to solicit public comments for a 45-day period about the possible effects and complexities of requiring the auditor with final responsibility for the audit to sign the audit report in addition to the firm's signature. We would be pleased to answer your questions at this time.
Thank you, Greg and Bella. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Mr. Harris.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board instruct the staff to issue the concept release on the engagement partner's signature on the audit report as recommended for public comment for a period of 45 days.
Is there a second?
Second, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Steve and Bill. The staff recommendation before the board today is a concept release on whether to require the engagement partner to sign the audit report. The board is seeking public comment on this concept release. I'd like to thank Bella Rivshin of the Office of the Chief Auditor and Jake Lesher and Mary Peters, Lesser, actually, in the Office of General Counsel for their research and efforts in preparing this concept release. This issue has been discussed for several years, including by our own standing advisory group and most recently by the U.S. Treasury Advisory Committee on the audit profession. There are many legitimate and strong arguments on both sides of the issue and robust debate as to whether it would improve audit quality. Beginning with the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley Act in 2002, Wall Street and the public have come to better understand the vital role of the audit profession in this country and around the world. There is increased scrutiny of the audit firms and the audit process by all stakeholders who have an interest in financial statements. While legitimate questions have been raised about the wisdom of requiring engagement signatures, my current belief is that the benefits from increased transparency will outweigh any negatives. I see wisdom, however, in today's initiative being a concept release and look forward to gaining the benefit from a robust and informative comment period. I will now turn to my fellow board members for comment, and appropriately, we will begin with Steve Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you indicated, the concept release we are considering today asks the public and the profession to comment on the pros and cons of requiring an engagement partner signature on the audit report. The lead auditor, the firm's senior representative on the audit team, would sign his or her name, validating the work of the audit team and the opinion it reached. I believe that requiring the engagement partner's signature on the audit report is important, not only to bring within the investor's reach a greater transparency and accountability in the auditing process, but also to advance the board's mission to protect the interests of investors and ensure the preparation of fair, informative, and independent audit reports. As you mentioned, in developing this concept release, the board considered not only the comments of investors, but the recommendations of the U.S. Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession and the advice of the PCAOB's own standing advisory group, as well as the opinions of a wide variety of other interested parties. In addition, the board reviewed international standards. The Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales may have said it best in its 2005 report on the subject. The engagement partner's signature will, quote, aid transparency and help to strengthen in investors' views independence and objectivity and confirm that the partner was not hiding behind the name of the firm, close quote. We are voting today on the issuance of this concept release to further public scrutiny and debate over the signature issue. The engagement partner plays a significant role in the overall quality of every audit. For investors, adding the partner's signature to the audit report acknowledges the engagement partner's key role in the overall quality of the audit and provides investors with another piece of relevant information about the audit. For audit committees, this additional information can aid audit committees in their auditor appointment or retention decisions. Audit committees also might be encouraged to learn more about and better understand the expertise of the individual partners providing auditing services to them. For auditors, firms may be encouraged to improve the quality and expertise of some of their engagement partners. For all these reasons, it is no surprise that investors and investor representatives who we have heard from overwhelmingly support a signature requirement. Here are a few sample comments. Damon Silvers, Associate General Counsel, AFL-CIO. Quote, to analogize to the SEC's world, when a 10K or S1 form is filed with the SEC, a lawyer's name is on the cover page of that document. Not a firm, but a name. Close quote. Lynn Turner, former SEC Chief Accountant. If auditors have a problem with signing the audit, then as an investor, I do want to know that, because that does give me informational content. Kurt Schack, Managing Director, CFA Institute, Center for Financial Market Integrity. I think this is really about the truth of the balance sheet. We support it as an investor group. Cynthia Richson, Director of Corporate Governance, Employees Retirement System of Texas. It would incent greater accountability. It would be informative. It would help clarify which part of the firm was involved in the engagement, in charge of it. Janice Hester Amy, Portfolio Manager, California State Teachers Retirement System. The simple step of requiring the audit partner to sign the audit report will, we believe, increase ownership of the audit by the audit team, a concept that will certainly help investors gain confidence in the quality of audits. Jeff Mahoney, General Counsel, Council of Institutional Investors. A number of council members are on record in support of the signature requirement, he said, adding, quote, I was struck that one of them at least put this item at the top of his list of things that he would do, that he thought would make an improvement. The board's current standard requires the firm itself to be the signatory on the audit report. This affirms the long-held view that the signature connotes the firm's responsibility to stand behind the quality of the audit. It also recognizes that an audit often involves many firm employees, consultation with the firm's national office, and sometimes outside consultants. Outside specialists. Nevertheless, as was pointed out in a recent Business Week article, quote, audits are primarily human endeavors, and audit firms are very dependent upon the quality of their professionals, including their competence and decision-making skills, close quote. The concept release recognizes the important role of the engagement partner in audit quality. Ultimately, it is his or her judgment, supervisory skill, and professional opinion that show up in the audit report. In the board's discussions with the SAG and in testimony heard before the Treasury's Advisory Committee, members of the profession, public companies, and academics noted the psychological effects of putting your John Hancock on an official and public document. Arnie Hanisch, Chief Accounting Officer, Eli Lilly and Company, said, "I think the accountability issue is critical. I think having the individual sign their name as a partner of a particular firm is probably most critical. You get different behaviors when somebody has to put their name on something." Donald Nicolaias, in Treasury's Advisory Committee co-chair and former SEC chief accountant, said, "I feel strongly that an audit partner should sign his or her known name in an audit opinion. I believe the investor should have the opportunity to know who it is who ultimately is accepting responsibility on behalf of the accounting firm to make sure that all the pieces came together." Paul Haga, vice chairman, Capital Research and Management Company, observed that a signature requirement, quote, could increase the sense of accountability and improve quality, similar to the requirements of CEOs and CFOs signing 10-Ks and internal control representations. "I would note that CEOs and CFOs must certify that their financial statements are fairly presented as mandated in Section 302 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. A recent research study found that practicing auditors said that those signature requirements had a positive effect on the integrity of financial reports." Similarly, a comment letter to the PCAOB from four distinguished academics who also are members of the auditing section of the American Accounting Association made this point, quote, "While the academic literature does not directly address the issue of partner sign-off, research shows that accountability, which would likely result from having to provide a personal signature on the audit report, reduces auditors' biases in information processing and enhances auditors' consensus and effort," close quote. "Based upon this and other opinions that the board has reviewed, I believe that an engagement partner signature requirement would increase the auditor's sense of accountability and responsibility for the audit report. It also would increase the transparency of the audit process for investors. I say this recognizing that some auditors are concerned that such a requirement would somehow increase their personal liability on the job. I would note that this issue was reviewed by the Treasury's Advisory Committee and by the European Parliament in its consideration of the EU 8th Directive, Article 28, Audit Reporting, and neither found the issue unmanageable in this context. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to carefully reading the comments we receive on this concept release and hope to hear from all parties, including audit practitioners, public companies, financial statement users, and most importantly, investors who supply the needed capital to these companies and whose interests are paramount to the board. I believe this is an important initiative, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing it before the board for a vote this morning. I would also like to thank our staff, Bella Rishon, Jake Lesser, and Mary Peters, for all their excellent work on this release." Bill Grandison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've looked forward to this day for a long time. I'm increasingly convinced that audit quality would be improved by adding a partner's signature to the audit report. Doing so would reflect the responsibility not only of the firm, but also of the engagement partner, as has already been mentioned so well by Steve. I have been struck by how often the engagement partner rather than the firm is responsible for deficiencies identified in PCAOB inspection reports. The support for adding the engagement partner's signature is growing, as has already been mentioned. It's reflected in the 8th Company Law Directive in 2006, as well as the Treasury's Advisory Committee late last year. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to public comments that the board will receive on this concept release.
Charlie Newmark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to start by thanking the staff, Bella, Jake, and Mary, for all their thoughtful work that went into this release. This idea has attracted considerable attention, including the support of the Treasury Department's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession last year. Given the attention, I think the release does a good job of describing what has been proposed in other circles and environments and asking questions that will help the board evaluate the merits of implementing it. For myself, I'm particularly interested in the question as to what problem would this requirement solve. Many people have compared the idea to the CEO and CFO certifications that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act now requires. As is well documented, CEOs and CFOs of companies with accounting problems previously routinely argued that they did not understand what was in the financial statements. In contrast, engagement partners rarely, if ever, deny responsibility for the audit report. They raise other defenses, but not that one. Nevertheless, it is undeniable that many people believe that requiring partners to sign their own names on a report would enhance their perception of their personal accountability for the opinion. And because of that wide-held belief, I support this concept release. As in the case of many proposed new requirements, it is often difficult to prove the benefits of requirement that has no track record in our environment. Therefore, I encourage commenters to focus on explaining whether engagement partners would perceive that signing their names to audit reports is materially different or would result in materially different type or amount of audit work, and if so, why. The second of the two questions posed today may be even more interesting than the first, at least to me, and that is the concept release highlights certain situations in which engagement partners today use work performed by people of varying proximity to the engagement partner, for example, work performed by network affiliates. If the auditors report that they would be troubled by a requirement personally to sign the audit report when that is part of a work has been performed by network affiliates, the problem, in my mind, may not be with assigning the report. The problem may instead be whether an engagement partner has sufficient level of comfort with the work of an affiliate to rely on this in the first place. This and the other questions in the release are well worth asking, and I support publishing it for comment. Thank you.
Dan Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the concept release the board is considering today notes, as others have already noted, the idea of requiring the engagement partner in his or her own name to sign a public company audit report is not new. Signature in the name of a firm has long been the norm in the United States. However, in 2006, the European Union's eighth directive required the signature of a natural person on audit reports. The board's standing advisory group discussed the possibility of requiring a partner signature along with the firm's signature in 2005, 2007, and again in 2008. Moreover, in October of 2008, the final report of the Department of the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession, known by the acronym ECAP, urged the board to undertake a standard-setting initiative to consider mandating the engagement partner's signature on the audit report. The ECAP report states that the engagement partner's signature would increase transparency and accountability. In light of this history, I think it's appropriate that the board begin a process to consider a partner signature requirement. Investor representatives at the SAG and ACAP discussions have consistently supported the idea that the engagement partner should be expected to put his or her own reputation on the line by signing the report that's the product of the audit he or she supervised. As Charlie Niemeyer noted, some have also analogized an engagement partner's signature to the CEO and CFO certifications required by Section 302 of Sarbanes-Oxley. Given the board's statutory mandate, I think we would be remiss if we didn't take seriously the ACAP recommendation to consider this idea. At the same time, I think it's prudent that the board is beginning this process with a concept release and not with a proposed requirement. One of the most powerful laws to which we're subject is the law of unintended consequences. Before the board decides whether, and if so, how, to implement a partner signature requirement, it's important that we learn as much as we can concerning the likely impact in order that we won't be surprised by the results. Along these lines, the concept release is aimed at generating input and views on a wide range of important issues that partner signature would raise. The release poses 16 questions for consideration by commenters. Issues that I consider particularly important include the following. What are the liability ramifications for the engagement partner? Are there steps the board could or should take to mitigate the likelihood of increasing an engagement partner's personal liability in private litigation? Should an engagement partner signature requirement be implemented in conjunction with revisions to the guidance in the existing standards regarding the responsibilities of an engagement partner? Are there tangible reasons to believe that engagement partner signature would improve audit quality? If engagement partner signature would indeed affect auditor behavior, how would the behavioral changes affect audit costs? What impact, if any, would engagement partner signature have on the ability of investors, other financial statement users, and audit committees to assess audit quality? If public identification of the engagement partner would be an important factor in selecting and evaluating an audit firm, would this promote or retard competition and concentration in public company auditing? I hope the concept release will generate thoughtful and practical answers to these and the other questions raised. I also hope that the commenters who oppose partner signature will make an effort to put themselves in the shoes of investors and other users who see the signature as a way of promoting individual responsibility and transparency. Conversely, I hope that the signature proponents will candidly assess the possible collateral consequences. Like others, I want to acknowledge the efforts of Stella Rifshin, the Office of the Chief Auditor, and Jay Klesser and Mary Peters in the Office of the General Counsel in bringing the Partner Signature Project to its current stage. I suspect this will just be the first of many several opportunities to thank you all for working on this project. This is very much the beginning of a complex subject. With that, let me ask you a couple of things. I appreciate this is a concept release, so we ourselves are just asking questions that we may not have all the answers, or we wouldn't be asking them, but to illuminate a couple of things. First of all, we've been talking the last half an hour about a requirement or a possible requirement that the engagement partner should sign the audit report. Because as I understand it, the phrase engagement partner doesn't appear anywhere in the standards, although the term auditor with final responsibility for the audit does. So who exactly is it that would have to sign these reports if there were an individual signature requirement?
Well, Dan, as you mentioned, the auditing standards refer to the engagement partner as the audit partner with final responsibility for the audit. And so it would be that individual who would have the responsibility to sign his or her own name on the audit report. Typically, that partner has the overall responsibility for overseeing the audit and signing the audit report. And the accounting firm typically designates one individual as the auditor for final responsibility of the audit.
I guess I spent a lot of time asking about definitions before, and I won't try to delve too deeply into that again, but is... Well, auditor with final responsibility a defined term, or as you just implied in your comments, is the firm free to designate anyone they like as the auditor with final responsibility for a particular engagement, regardless of how much or how little work they may have actually done on that engagement?
Well, actually, the board's auditing standards do define two terms. One is the auditor with final responsibility for the audit, and the other is assistant. And I'll take those in reverse. They define assistant as any firm personnel that is not the auditor with final responsibility for the audit, thereby meaning that anybody who's not an assistant is the auditor with final responsibility for the audit. The auditing standards provide high-level direction for both of those categories and provide specific direction in certain instances for the auditor with final responsibility as it relates to supervising and planning the audit. There are some specific recommendations requirements for the auditor with final responsibility to attend the brainstorming session and other requirements in AU 316 as it relates to fraud. Therefore, under the board's auditing standards, you couldn't have a situation in which you had a partner who did not perform any work on the audit to be designated as the auditor with final responsibility for the audit.
At least they'd have to go to the brainstorming.
They would. If there are certain requirements, they would at least have to perform. Yes.
Well, I won't go further into whether firms might identify some judgment-proof person and tell them to attend all brainstorming sessions and sign all audit reports. But I guess along those lines, it seems to me that signing could signify at least two different things. And one is that the person signing believes that the firm's opinion is accurate or doesn't have any reason to think that the firm's opinion is inaccurate. And the other would be they've performed the responsibilities that the standard lays out for an engagement partner, for an auditor with final responsibility. so I wonder then if we're going to go down this signature road, if we might not have to define with more precision what the responsibilities of that auditor with final responsibility for the engagement are. I mean, I think that's something that's asked in the release. I don't know if you guys have a reaction to it here, but it seems to me that's an important subject we're going to have to do a thing to.
I think, Dan, that is a very important subject, and the staff looks forward to receiving the comments on the concept release, and I think if the board determines that it's appropriate to require this type of signature requirement, then the staff will consider whether the board's auditing standards should provide more detail or specificity regarding the responsibilities of the auditor with final responsibility for the audit.
The release also holds out the possibility, or just asks about whether requiring a signature might be a kind of a pro-competitive step, because audit committees would increasingly seek out engagement partners who are viewed as performing high-quality audits, and then that in turn might be an incentive to firms to increase the quality or just training, whatever, of their engagement partners so that they will be sought out. I wonder if something like that doesn't exist in the legal profession today, where at least it's sometimes said that clients hire the partner, not the firm, and of course the other side of that coin is that prominent lawyers demand higher billing rates and have much easier opportunities to, you know, to move from firm to firm in response to economic incentives. Again, it's a question in the release, but I wonder if you think that might be the road that the auditing profession would go down, and if that would be a good or a bad thing in terms of competition and concentration of water.
Well, I think there are some similarities to that, but I would also note that the potential requirement for the auditor with final responsibility to sign the audit report would not replace the current requirement of the firm's signature. The firm signature serves as an important goal, and the intent of any signature would not be a new signature requirement, would not be to suggest that the firm as a whole is still not accountable for the contents of the audit report, or that the engagement partner is still responsible for the audit. This would be in addition to the current signature requirement of the firm. The firm signature on the audit report may also reflect the fact that the audit often involves consultations with other firm personnel, such as national office, other partners with specialized expertise, and who may not directly participate in the day-to-day work on that audit. So I think if you would still have both signatures if the board chooses to do so, and it would still reflect many other individuals that have performed work.
Well, it'll be interesting, I think, to see how people react to this, just in terms of the impact we have on competition.
I would also add, Dan, that the audit committee is well aware of the engagement partner from the inception. You know, when they take on a new engagement, the engagement partner and who that person is very important to the audit committee, because you not only they develop a close relationship, a lot of trust goes on between within this relationship, but also when that engagement partner has to rotate off due to SEC rotation rules, then you have a new engagement partner on, and again they go through the same process that that person, an individual that initially assigned, you know, the audit committee has to be acceptable and has to be pleasing to them, because they want to make sure this is the right person, has the right experience, the right, you know, has the number of years, but has the appropriate experience in that particular industry and area, and so they're going to scrutinize that person and make sure it's the right one. So it's the name of that person to the audit committee and who that person is, yes, is very important.
Well, they don't, at least as I was understanding, they don't really have the ability today to look at, well, easily, who's the engagement partner of our competitors, our peers, the big company down the street. I don't know if that would have an impact on.
Well, it's not evident right today in the published media, but in publications out there, but the engagement partner of the firms is available and makes himself publicly available at the annual shareholders meetings. And so they are there in front of the public and to answer questions and respond to any inquiries they may have. So they are there, and they know who they are at that time.
Well, Let me ask you about something I suspect we're going to hear a lot about in these comments, and that's the impact, or possible impact, on the personal monetary liability of the engagement partner, or the person who might be signing these reports. And the release does acknowledge, I think, candidly, that there could be an impact on liability. As I understand, at least 10b-5 law, if a statement is publicly or attributable to an identified person, then that may affect cause them to have liability in circumstances where the public doesn't know that they're relying on a specific individual. It's much nicer to be a client than a lawyer. I mean, before I venture further down that, I wonder if anybody could just briefly outline what they think the law in that area is.
Well, I think I'm going to turn it over to our Office of General Counsel to answer that question.
Sure, let me try that. And at the outset, I should probably clarify two things. First, the release before the board today does not suggest, nor has anyone else during the consideration of this issue suggested, to my knowledge, that the signature requirement would affect the firm's liability itself, or, for that matter, add to the aggregate liability of the firm and the individual engagement partner might face for a decision on it. Second, as the release also notes, engagement partners today currently face liability in board and SEC enforcement actions without regard to whether they sign the audit report. Accountants, as you noted, may be held liable in a variety of contexts. Your question specifically raised Section 10B and Rule 10b-5, which is a significant source of liability. With respect to that, the Supreme Court has not specifically spoken to the question of when an actor makes a statement for purposes of primary liability under that section, and there's no consensus on that point in the lower court, as you alluded to. In some federal courts, such as the Ninth Circuit, anyone who substantially participates in the making of a statement may be primarily liable for it. In other circuits, such as the Second, the statement must be directly or at least constructively attributed to that person for that person to be held liable, primarily liable. So the concept release before you would note the unsettled law in that question and invite comment on what effect, if any, an engagement partner's signature requirement would have on the engagement partner's liability in private litigation, including Section 10b action.
Well, again, I think as somebody alluded to already, the Treasury Advisory Committee's report says that signature shouldn't have an impact on partner liability. But whether that's a legal opinion on their part or a recommendation as to how this should be implemented is not clear to me, at least. I mean, do you think there's something we could do to affect? We can affect whether there's exposure in our enforcement proceedings. But is there anything we can do to affect exposure to private liability? Or maybe more to the point, is there anything the SEC could do? The SEC does have safe harbors in their rules and certain other context. Could they do something to address this issue if they think that's appropriate, or would this have to be a matter for Congress?
Well, to start with, I mean, you're correct, of course, that the board doesn't have direct power to change the application of the securities laws by the courts in private action. Whether the SEC could create an effective safe harbor is a complicated question that would depend in part on what provision of the securities laws they were creating a safe harbor from. I would note that the Treasury Advisory Committee, in raising this issue, did note that the SEC created a safe harbor from Section 11 liability for Audit Committee financial experts when it promulgated its rules on that subject. And while I can't speak for the SEC or its staff on a legal question, there may well be some ability for them to create a safe harbor if there were additional liability under Section 11 and if they thought it appropriate to do so. So I think, again, more generally, if this turns into rulemaking and the board comes to believe that the requirement would impose some unwarranted increase in partner liability, I expect that's something we'd want to consult further with the SEC staff about to determine whether that's something they had the ability and inclination to address.
Okay, thank you. Well, just a couple other quick things. In the EU directive, I believe there's a provision for getting an exemption from partner signature requirement on a case-by-case basis. Do we have any idea how that's operated in practice? Has anybody ever gotten an exemption, or under what circumstances?
Well, Dan, as you pointed out, the EU provides for an exception because of a significant threat to personal security. The requirement in the directive is relatively new. I believe that the first disclosure provision would apply for fiscal years that ended on June 30th, 2009. So we don't have much information right now of how situations that have warranted that exemption or how it has been used so far. We are seeking comment on whether a possible exemption would be appropriate in this circumstance and under what situation it would be used. We recognize that the exemption, if granted, could raise other questions too, such as why an engagement partner signature was not listed and the possible consequences of omitting an engagement partner signature. Certainly this is an issue, an area that we would need to carefully consider.
And again, and that is, I believe, among the 16 questions that are asked.
Yes.
And there are a lot of technical questions here about exactly what the scope of this signature would be, what it would cover. And I think you alluded to situations where there's another auditing firm involved, either specifically mentioned or not specifically mentioned in the signing firms and issuing firms report, and possible reference to other engagement partners involved. I'm not sure exactly why that would be a reference rather than their signature, if they're worth mentioning, but I guess that's a question for the commenters too. Let me just ask you one specific thing. Do we envision that this signature would cover both the opinion on the financial statements and the opinion on the company's internal controls? Or would those be, bifurcated somehow, or would the scope be limited to the financial statements?
It would cover both. Clearly. It would have to.
I look forward to the comments on this. I suspect we'll get a lot of them, and that they'll be very diverse.
I suspect you're exactly right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm increasingly struck by the fact that the international community seems to be far ahead of us in a number of transparency and accountability issues. And this is just one example. I think we ought to be the gold standard. But when I review what's being done abroad with respect to transparency and accountability, I think we got a little catch-up work to do. I'm fully aware of the liability concerns that have been raised, but somehow or other they've been dealt with abroad. And now, granted that there are different legal systems and liability systems, but the European Parliament, in its Article 28 directive, states, where an audit firm carries out the statutory audit, the audit report shall be signed by at least the statutory auditors carrying out the statutory audit on behalf of the audit firm. In exceptional circumstances, member states may provide that this signature need not be disclosed to the public if such disclosure could lead to an imminent and significant threat to the personal security of any person. In any case, the names of the persons involved shall be known to the relevant competent authorities. Same thing in the UK Companies Act of 2006. Senior statutory auditor is not, by reason of being named or identified as a senior statutory auditor, by reason of his having signed the auditor's report, subject to any civil liability to which he would not otherwise be subject. And then, as Bell has referenced, both of these, the Treasury Advisory Committee, the committee's final report notes the signature requirement should not impose on any signing partner any duties, obligations, or liability that are greater than the duties, obligations, and liability imposed on such person as a member of an auditing firm. This language is similar to safe harbor language the SEC promulgated in its rulemaking pursuant to the Sarbanes-Oxley Section 407 for Audit Committee Financial Experts. So I think there may be a number of ways to potentially deal with this issue. I also want to note that, I do appreciate the auditor liability issues associated with the engagement partner signing the audit report. However, as I said earlier, these issues were discussed by commentators the Treasury Advisory Committee and by our SAG and are reviewed in the board's release. I think it's important to note that in all of those discussions, no one has suggested that having the engagement partner sign the audit report would increase the firm's liability in any respect. The previous discussions also note that the lead engagement partner already may be held responsible today in proceedings brought by the SEC and PCAOB, as well in some types of private litigation for seriously deficient audits that harm investors. Since the engagement partner is designated by the auditing standards as the person with final responsibility for the audit, I think some investors may be surprised to learn that there could be any situations today in which a firm can be found liable in private litigation for an audit, but the lead engagement partner for that audit faces little or no personal legal responsibility. More generally, as I think it's been referred to, the PCAOB's mission is to promote high professional standards, to improve audit quality, and to further the public interest in the preparation of informative, fair, and independent audit reports. In considering standards related to the preparation of audit reports, the critical question is how well the standard will advance those objectives. In some cases, standards that advance those objectives in important respects may pose some prospect of liability that did not previously exist. I believe that we should not approach every standard setting as if we may pursue our mission only in ways that would avoid any potential for any new liability. In any event, I am not persuaded the concepts we are discussing today would do so in any significant way. And again, as I stressed at the outset, I look forward to reading the comment letters from all interested parties to the subject.
Thank you. If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. There is no further
business. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, there is one additional item of business which is not on the agenda, and that is to recognize that this is going to be your last meeting here with us as our chairman, to thank you for the opportunity to have you here to lead us, to keep our minds always focused on what is in the best interest of investors, and to just be a great guy to work with. So you're going to be missed. And I'm sorry to ask you to digress from the canned agenda which we are working with, but I felt this was sufficiently important to go against normal protocol.
Well, thank you, Bill, and thank all of you. And
well, Mr. Chairman, it's long as Bill. I just wanted to say how very much I appreciate your friendship over the years and the opportunity to work with you. I mean, we go way back, and I appreciate that very much. You made my transition to the PCAOB a very easy one, and you've always had a very open door to me. In addition to your work and leadership on among many other issues, they include internal controls, helping to take the PCAOB from a startup to a steady state operation, overseeing a risk-based approach to inspections, enhancing and expanding our Office of Research and Analysis, attracting experienced top talent to the PCAOB, establishing the board's first strategic plan, enhancing coordination and cooperation with the board's, with the PCAOB's international counterparts, and I could go on at some length. You've also, among other things, laid the foundation for increasing investor participation at the board and internationally, increasing the board's transparency with respect to our website, and improving our process for reviewing inspection reports. So for all these reasons, I want to thank you.
You're very welcome.
Sounds like you've been pretty good.
Thank you.
Well, let me just say thank you.
I'm rather enjoying this. So for those of you,
well, we all have choices. You had a number of choices. You've left a very great position, actually, and to come join us. And thank you for being our leader for these last 3 years, and I've enjoyed working with you as well.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you.
Well, it's hard to think of what to add after those comments, but let me just say it's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with you, and I think these have been three remarkably successful years.
Well, I'm getting more credit than I deserve today, but today I'll take it. So thanks to all of you. And I've said I think many times over the years that I'll probably get more credit than I deserve for the work that all of you do, and that certainly has been the case. I hope everybody here knows that much of the credit that's gone to all of us is the work that we've done collectively. So thanks to all of you. And with that, I'll adjourn the meeting, and I'll adjourn the open meeting, and we'll reconvene the closed meeting right at 12. Thank you very much.